Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one of your hosts, Aaron Bresnitz. Hope everyone is staying safe, staying sane, taking care of yourself, checking in with others, getting a vaccine plan in place, more and more and more. And more slots are opening up. Also, a big shout out to all of our friends in Texas and everyone else affected by these crazy winter storms. Just because they're out of the news doesn't mean they don't need your help. So please check in, see how you can donate resources, time, even just send some positive vibes. Anything goes a long way. We are super excited to be sitting down with Alan Delgado, Director of R&D at Via Halcon Hospitality, and the CDC at Zilonen, which is a new sustainable vegan vegetarian Mexican restaurant over in Greenpoint. It's a really great conversation. We talk about him growing up and what he learned from cooking from his mother, his journey to cooking in Brooklyn, and some of the time he spent cooking in Austin. Really fun, great times, very delicious. I cannot wait to get back to Brooklyn to eat at this restaurant. And then we go into the archives. We have a band from Danger Bird, the Pantheons, really, really great band from LA. Bit of a 60s vibe, bit of a punk vibe, bit of a new wave vibe. All in all, just a whole lot of fun. And something that we think you'll really enjoy diving back into. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
We talk about food. We talk about music. With musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
I got a dance with the burning bar. When you agree with your priest, you apply. Give me everything and all our desires. You can't even put cereal, the devil to admire. The rat is off through the gates. The witch in our sight is at my window pane. The thief in the night and then from the pain. A grapple with these teeth, how is that bad? Silent venom and death to no goal. We get a cold fight, the little brain is gone. They got a cigarette, steal my ashes, they're gone. So take a run somewhere to live until the dawn. Possess the quality the heartbeat would need. Take to an open wound, many pins of salt. As if the raven dogs only acted your fault. I can't sleep, face, surround the stars. Through the city, which in hours back is at my window pane. The thief in the night, and then far from fame. The proper wicked king, I wish I ran an eight. Silent and venom is down to no throne. When you're in a gold light, the vision breaks with the stars. Flick of a cigarette, until my eyes.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us. Really appreciate you taking time out of the busy schedule that you have right now.
Thank you for having me. It was always fun.
Yeah. So you grew up on the Texas Chihuahua border. What do you remember about the food from your childhood, and what stayed with you from those early memories?
Well, yeah, I was born in El Paso. We lived in Juarez for up until I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
And then, you know, my dad had a good opportunity in El Paso to make more money and support the family. So we moved. And I don't know, for me, I was immersed in Mexican cuisine, Mexican culture. And, you know, being in the border, El Paso is just kind of a second little Mexico.
Sure.
And so, you know, I grew up eating a lot of enchiladas and, you know, calabacitas, just really home-cooked meals. My mom cooked a lot, or she cooked every day, all the meals. And so, you know, I do remember the enchiladas from my mom, though. Mm. That's the one thing that sticks with me.
Yeah. Your mom was a big culinary influence on you, right? What did she teach you? Do you remember getting in the kitchen at a young age, or was it just like food comes out from the kitchen, but I don't really associate it from like something being scratch and then a meal? There just seems to be something delicious coming out.
The smells always attracted me into the kitchen. But you're not really allowed to help a lot as a kid. But when I was around 12, 13 years old, my mom became very, very ill. Mm. And so she wasn't able to cook a lot for us anymore. And so that's when I kind of started cooking for her, because she had a really strict diet. Like, she couldn't eat any animal proteins, nothing with alcohol, nothing with too much salt. And so, you know, I just started cooking for her, since she cooked for us forever. And, you know, I started taking care of her, and I don't know, it was just fun being in there and creating recipes for her.
I mean, that seems like a lot of responsibility and a steep learning curve, because not only are you now cooking as a kid, which is a lot. I mean, it's a lot as an adult to cook for a family, but then to also have a specific healthy diet. How did you learn? Where did you go to? And I mean, what year is this? Because like, this is, you know, it's not like you can just now you just go to the internet, right? You just open up your phone and you're like, I want to cook a specific diet. How do I cook it? Here's 10 recipes. But what was it like back then?
Yeah.
How did it feel to be the person putting up the food for the family?
Well, by the time I started cooking for her, I was around, 15, 16, right?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. It's not that difficult. You know, when you have certain parameters and guidelines, you kind of just, you know, if they're you remove animal protein, if you remove alcohol, if you don't add as much salt, you know. Luckily, Mexican cuisine has a lot of spices and peppers that you can kind of work your way around that to find something that is flavorful. But, I don't know, cooking with veggies was fun and easy, because you can always cook rice. Either you can always have a base of beans or rice or pasta or whatever, and then just build upon that. And so it was just like a little formula that you start to develop, you know, A plus C or A plus B equals C. And so you just learn to adapt, and you learn what things go well together, what things don't. And so obviously your mom's never going to tell you that your food sucks, but.
Well, depending on who your mom or grandma is, they might tell you that your food sucks. It might be
not
like,
my mom, I'll tell you that.
No. So getting in the kitchen, 15, 16, you know, that's around the time when people start thinking about, what am I going to do with my life? Was that the trigger for wanting you to work in food full time, or did that come a little bit later?
Kind of. I mean, that was also the time where Food Network was pretty fun.
What year is this?
2000... How old am I? 32? This was, 16 years ago?
Yeah, so about 2004, 2005. It was pretty fun.
Yeah, and then so I would always just jump between Food Network and, what was it? Animal Planet or something like that. There was like a vet show.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like an ER vet show, and I love that. And so, I don't know, I at that age, I was either going to be a vet or a chef. And a dog that I had passed away, and I was like, man, I can't stomach this. I can't see pets die all the time. And so, you know, I tried college after that, but I really hated being in a classroom. Mm. And so I started partying. I dropped out of college. And then I tried culinary school in Austin. That's when I moved to Austin. Mm. So I was like, I didn't like studying civil engineering. And so I went to school for, culinary arts, which I also hated being in culinary school. I think it was a waste of money and time for me. But that's how I got started. So I started with my mom, you know, being sick and having to cook for her. And then just watching TV and all of those Le Cordon Bleu commercials, really.
So you were in Austin at a really interesting time. You know, it had started to really come into its own as a food city. You know, anyone who was there, even till the early, mid-aughts, it was still Tex-Mex barbecue. You know, there was Uchi. But now it was really exploding into all these different types of cuisine. So what was it like to be there, and who were you working for? Who did you fall in with during that time?
Let's see. I got there in 2008. Uchi was there was just about to open, I think. Mm-hmm. And then, Bryce Gilmore and Barley Swine on Mar. That was my favorite restaurant at the time.
I love it. You dip the whole staff of beer on the menu.
Yeah.
That was
my favorite restaurant. To this day, it's still one of my favorite spots.
The hay smoked egg, if I remember correctly, was one of the legendaries.
They were having fun, man.
Yeah.
You could see it in the cooks. You could see it in the front of the house staff. It was just like.
And it was unique to be in Austin. Yeah, because that restaurant, I remember eating there and saying like, oh, Austin can be something that pulls from different inspirations, but really unique because of its location.
Right, yeah, and I think Bryce really made Austin happen the way it is now. You know, I don't know if he gets enough credit for how that city like really blew up culinary-wise, you know, and he created some great talent out of there.
Yeah.
And, but I started at a, old school Italian restaurant called, Treehouse Italian Grill on College Avenue in Congress. mm-hmm. And, it was quite a learning curve. That was my first, real restaurant experience. I had worked at Outback in El Paso, a busboy and a dishwasher. And, but moving there, that was my first like line cook, but then I was promoted to like GM and kitchen chef. It was so weird with no kitchen experience. And so it was wild just learning how to learn what the fuck I was doing. no one had taught me.
I think sometimes when you get those training moments at an Outback Steakhouse, which is a lot of the way that people get into the restaurant industry, if you don't do culinary school, even if you do, or do you just – you know, there's so many ubiquitous chain restaurants. You're like, okay, I'm in and I like this world. And then you go to a no-name or Italian place and you go, oh, I'm going to cut my teeth here. By the time you actually get to – because you wound up at Sway and Launderette and Carpenter's Hall. It's like, these aren't my first jobs. Like, I recognize, like, these four walls at least. And, like, a rhythm of, like, what a night feels like for a busy night on the line.
Yeah, it was all mom and pop shops for like the first 4 years for me, you know, because from there I went to the Whippin, which is another mom and pop shop. They were my crazy wild days, but it was fun because everyone around me was around the same age. Right. And so we're all hopeful and dreaming and talking about the future and what we want to do. And so you're just kind of encouraging each other to follow your dreams. And it was a fun time for me to be in Austin. And like you said, from there I jumped around because I wanted to learn as much as possible, you know, and I was never one of those that would stay at a job for more than a year. But I was also the kind of person that had 3 to 4 jobs at the same time.
Gotcha.
And so I just wanted to learn. And I think what I got from culinary school wasn't what I really wanted. I wanted to, you know, really know what it's like to be in a kitchen and not be in the, like those fancy kitchens that have all the ovens that work and that have no plumbing issues and sure. have new hotel pans and all that. So for the most part, the restaurants that I worked at were where you just had to make shit happen, tie some things together so that it, you know, you have it for service and just survive kind of, which was, I think it has helped me a lot in the long run, especially nowadays where people are like, oh my God, this broke. What do I do? And he's like, just find a solution.
Find a solution. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's important to really get good experience. I think a lot of people in the restaurant industry see social media now, or they see it's like maybe shortcuts. And at the end of the day, like there is a business, there is a sort of a more bird's eye approach to running a restaurant than just making food to put on Instagram and things like that. There are like the day-to-day things that you just learn from experience, which I think is one of the tougher things about culinary school, right? Like people just don't learn some of those real life fundamentals in a classroom, which you could say for anything, but
right.
the cost of culinary school and what you actually get out of it, it's a tough sell, especially these days.
Yeah. And, you know, like you said, it is a business in the end, and it's a little tricky because a lot of us get into this industry because it's a passion, you know, it's something that you love to do and that excites you. And once you start getting into the numbers and how everyone has a price tag above their head, and after 40 hours, that price tag doubles a little bit. And if you're not making enough money, so you start thinking of that, and then you kind of lose track of why you got into this industry, right?
Yeah.
That passion is kind of, is taking a backseat because, you know, if you don't have a financially healthy restaurant, then it doesn't really matter what you make or what you cook because you won't have a place to cook it in. Right. And so at first I would get mad because I didn't understand that part, you know, like I just want to cook some beautiful food and why can't we do it? And so I didn't understand the business side of it until, you know, like 6 years later when I became a sous chef and had to really work with labor and food costs and all of that. And then you're like, holy shit, when do we cook then? Like, how are we supposed to create food when all your time is focused on making sure no one has overtime or making sure that you're not wasting any food or, you know, there's so much that goes into it that it takes away sometimes from the passion and creativity.
But did you find that once you got over the frustration of not just being able to do what you wanted, but you actually understood the business, and that gave you a new perspective or, you know, lane for creativity because you understood within the parameters that you could work and like how you could make something and still feel business, you know, business-wise good about what you're making and what you're doing?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like it adds more value to you if you know how to run a restaurant successfully from the business aspect. You know, if you're able to keep a restaurant healthy, then no one's ever going to tell you to go away because you're making the people above you happy. Yeah. You don't have to worry about that part. And if you train that, if you teach your staff how to think that way, then it allows you to eventually just step away a little bit and then be able to start to create recipes and create new dishes and, you know, give yourself a budget so that you can bring in other things, you know? And so I think once you learn that and you accept it and you realize that if you ever want to own a restaurant yourself, that those are the things that you're going to focus on because it's your name, it's your money, and you want to be able to be around for a while. And so, you know, like I tell all my cooks, it doesn't matter if you make the most beautiful food or the best tasting food. If you have nowhere to cook it at, or if you have no place to put it on, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that is a lesson that applies to a lot of creative endeavors these days. we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about your move from Austin to New York and getting involved with Zilonen, the new restaurant where you are the CDC. And we're going to take a musical break. Hear the song from the archives on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Alan Delgado. And when we left the break, you were still in Austin. You'd figured out sort of how to both make food and also have a restaurant as a business, which is something that is rarer and rarer, I think, with a young chef or someone who is younger in this field. But the reputation of your work and being able to actually run a restaurant must have gotten out because you were tapped to come to Brooklyn to run or at least work with the recipe development at the Michelin-starred Oshimoko. How did you get involved with the guys? How did you get tapped? How did that happen? How did you get plucked out of Austin and brought to New York?
I think that's one of the beauties of social media, right?
There you get
to network with people that aren't in your damn city.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that you hear from both sides, right? Like, I don't cook for Instagram or I only cook for Instagram or this and that. But I think, again, it's a very powerful tool, especially if you want to, if you use it right, if you use it for your work. And if you want to network, then it's a great way to reach out to other people. It's a great way for other people to see you. And so, you know, that's primarily why I use Instagram, is because there's not a lot of conventions for chefs to go and like meet with owners.
I don't think there's really any other way unless it's like, yeah, I dropped into your city, but that's sort of eradicated in the last year.
Yeah. And so it's a good way to network, right? There's some negatives to it where eventually all of our food starts to look the same because you're inspired by other dishes or other chefs. And so, but you know, when I was at Comedor,
shout out Justin
Justin reached out to Gabe Virales to, cause he wanted to open this place, the Zilonen, but when he had reached out, it was pre-COVID. And so the plans for Zilonen were a lot different than what they are now. You know, it was supposed to be in Manhattan in a hotel and this and that and blah, blah. And then, so I was supposed to come, what was it, last year in March and do a tasting for Justin, and then COVID hit. And so it's funny, I was going to take a vacation because I hadn't taken one in a long time since you work in the industry. And yeah, I was in Amsterdam and then COVID hit. Fly back, and so my vacation was cut short, but I was in El Paso with my dad and my family for a while, for a month or so, and then Justin reached out again. You know, we stayed in contact, and he reached out, said that they were gearing up to open Zilonen, and asked if I wanted to move up here. And you know, it's been a lifelong dream. I think since I started cooking, the goal has always been to be in New York. And when he offered, I said, hell yeah.
You know, it's an interesting thing because if COVID showed us anything, or even the last few years with social media, that you don't have to be in one of the top five American culinary cities or top five culinary cities in the world, right? Like, you can go to these smaller towns and open up a restaurant and get national, international awareness because of social media. But there is that pull of New York, right? There is that pull of saying, if not for forever, that I went to New York, I opened a restaurant, and it was successful. And, you know, it's one thing to do R&D, what they brought you, but you are now the CDC at Zilonen. What was it like to get brought in? What's it like to have that responsibility? You know, what's it like to, because you helped open it. Like, what is that journey like?
It's fun. I think the challenge during COVID was that, like, you're not putting food on plates, right?
Yeah.
You walk into a restaurant and there's boxes everywhere.
Sure.
It looks like an episode of Hoarders. It wasn't a while.
Yeah.
And the mentality changes, honestly, because you walk in and you're like, here we go again. And so the first goal was to break out of that cycle, you know, like in the end, we're still receiving product. We're still fucking prepping. We're still cooking and we're still going to push food out, right? That part has not changed. And That was the first goal of mine, was to how do we break out of this cycle, right? And so clean out the dining room, make it look like we're going to be open for service every day, even if we're not. Maintain the kitchen cleanliness, organization, like all of that was the top priority. And so we went through that cycle first. And then once we were ready to open, instead of thinking of like, oh, we got to put food in boxes, it was, what can we cook that makes us happy? You know, we're going to be in here. We're going to be during this pandemic, right? Working around other people in close proximity. So why not make the best of it? Why not have fun doing it? And so that's how we attacked it, right? As if like the pandemic didn't exist. I mean, obviously it does, but we went ahead and just had fun. And I think that that was what allowed us to continue to do what we're doing. And, you know, it is challenging. It is draining. Every restaurant is just running with a bare staff. And so everyone, I feel like you've worked more during these times than before. And so it's tiring, but you know, if you involve the staff, if everyone is in it, then you have a good chance of making some dope food. And you know, that's what we've been doing and trying to inspire each other.
Let's talk about the food a little bit, because It is definitely a novel approach in some ways to opening a Mexican restaurant. You know, it's almost all vegan, right? With some vegetarian dishes. And that sometimes...
Just two.
Pardon?
Just two veggie dishes.
Just two veggie dishes. So let's just call it, for better, you know, for all intents and purposes, a vegan restaurant, which, you know, can bump with people's perception of Mexican food, especially when you hear a guy from Austin is coming up and opening a Mexican restaurant. You start thinking like, okay, I have a good idea. There's going to be queso and there's going to be, you know, all these meats and things like that. But sustainability and healthier or vegetarian, or, you know, this whole mix of new approach to cooking is a big core tenet of what you're making, right? And it's not, you know, it's not saying that the other type of Mexican food or Tex-Mex is bad or anything like that. It's just a different way of looking at Mexican food and a different sort of education to people think there's only one monolithic approach to Mexican food. What made you want to cook this way? And what are you bringing to the conversation that people may have never seen before?
Well, for me, this is a little more of a personal journey, since, like I said, I started cooking vegan Mexican food for my mom. And so this is kind of like a little full circle. But what I am bringing, I guess, is, you know, I was having this conversation with a friend yesterday, because when it comes to Mexican food, it seems like everyone has an opinion as to what Mexican food is.
Right.
And what it isn't. And
I think that last part is actually the most important. It's, people are so set on being like, this isn't Mexican food. It's like, you're literally talking about an entire country that has so many regions. It's enormous.
Different climates.
Different climates, different spices. Different, you know, landlocked, ocean, you know, all the stuff.
All of that. And, you know, it's all about experiences too. You know, if you grew up poor, you only had certain access to certain ingredients, right? If you grew up wealthy or a little better off than other people, then you were allowed to travel. You were allowed to experience other cuisines, other taste, other spices or product. And as a younger person, you want to take what you know and expand on it, right? And so all I'm showcasing is my opinion and my life experiences. You know, my dad is from Torreon, Coahuila. My mom was from Gomez Palacios, Coahuila as well. And so we grew up in Chihuahua. All my family's Mexican. And so, but I lived in America, right? And I've traveled in America. I've gone to Europe. I've tried different cuisines. And so for me, this is me gathering all that knowledge, what I like and what I didn't, and putting it together and saying, this is my experience of Mexican cuisine. Does it mean it's regional? No. Does it mean it's like traditional? No, I hate traditional stuff. You know, there's hundreds of traditional Mexican restaurants. Why can't there be something else that's a little different, you know? And for me, that was the goal, was to not make it traditional, to, you know, honor the traditions, obviously, of treating the corn properly. If sure. we make mole, to make it the right way. But does that mean that there can't be new moles? No. That's what we're here for. That's why there's young people around, to take the old traditions and make them, turn them into new traditions, right? And to create new environments and new experiences for people, for them to think that way and eventually put their seal on Mexican cuisine. And but it's funny, yeah, the more I post, the more people reach out and say that that's not Mexican cuisine, and to stop shitting on their heritage. And for me, it's funny because, like, oh, I didn't know you were the founder of Mexican cuisine. And so, like,
you know,
it's hilarious.
It's ridiculous. And it's a lot of times it's people who just don't understand maybe your approach. I mean, look, you understood the fundamentals of running a restaurant that allows you to be more creative, right? And allows mm-hmm. you to give people tools so you can do more R&D and create more menus. Yeah. In the same way that you understand the traditional foundations of Mexican cuisine, which then allows you to say, I'm going to take the base and fundamentals and make a Mexican cuisine the way that I see it. And it's just understanding those fundamentals and saying, I respect where it's coming from, but as a chef, as an artist, I'm allowed to push it forward. I'm allowed to keep the conversation going.
Yeah. And they're all just opinions on a plate.
Yeah.
And if you don't like my opinion, then you don't have to pay for it.
No, and go to the, and knowing where you are in Greenpoint, you know, you just head down a couple more blocks. You can get a couple of different, types of Mexican food in that area alone. If you're not in the mood for what you're serving up.
Yeah. So it's okay. You know, it's so weird how much people just have an opinion about Mexican cuisine.
You were talking about the flip side of social media, and this is it, right? Like this is the other side of the coin of where you can make really great food and have it on Instagram, and people will pick you out from a different state and say, we want you to oversee this operation because we believe in your vision. And then on the other side of that coin, people going like, that's not a burrito. That's not a quesadilla. That's not a taco. That's not this, that, and the other thing.
Right.
So as you opened up at the end of last year, you know, you're sort of heading into like your first full year of operation, the city's opening back up again. You know, what do you want the restaurant's place to be in the community? What would you like to do with it? What do you see as the future, and how would you like to keep the conversation going with the food you're cooking and the business you're running?
Well, I think with the aspect of sustainability alone, I think if more of us were to do that, we would have a big impact on the world. You know, I think that with so many restaurants and the amount of food waste that we create, the amount of plastic that we use, we're really killing the earth. And so, but there's not enough demand for people to create all of these products that we need that are eco-friendly, that aren't using paper, that aren't using plastic. And so I would like the conversation to continue on how we can create the demand for companies to see this and create things that are going to be sustainable for us, you know, because it's difficult to get away from quart containers. There's nothing that can substitute that. There's nothing that can get away from like plastic wrap, right? I know restaurants have done it, but we don't, you know, we're working with Oceanic Global to achieve our goals and all of that, but it's still a challenge, and it's expensive. It's really expensive. And so you're adding that on top of the day-to-day operations to run a restaurant, and then COVID, and having to buy more to-go containers and, you know, sanitizing wipes and all of that stuff. You're just taking on more. And so, but that's one aspect that I would like for this conversation to continue, but also the conversation of not consuming animal products all the time, every day. And it's been a huge eye opener, and I found a lot of respect for vegans. Honestly, it's a tough way to eat. I think, especially when you're trying to recreate items that, like fried chicken, you're never going to recreate fried chicken. Mm-mm. You know, you're never going to recreate a steak, and so I think that's where you kind of hit a wall And I think that if you think that way, you're going to always hit a wall. But if you try to just take the product that you have, that Earth has given us, and make beautiful food and try to make great desserts, then we're on the right track. And I think that the conversation should continue with that.
I'm with you. Whenever I've gone a little meat light in my diet or things like that, I've never been drawn to the replacement products. I just say, give me carrots, beets, cauliflower, give me what the earth is offering. I don't need to eat the replacement version of it. Alan, thank you so much for taking the time. Congratulations on everything. If people want to visit the restaurant, see the menu, follow you on Instagram, where can they go?
The website is, zlonin.earth. And we're at 905 Lorimer in Greenpoint.
Great location.
7 days a week, 10 to 9.
Arguably one of the most popular and well-known corners in the Greenpoint, Williamsburg area. Right off the park.
It's beautiful, right next to the park. Yeah.
I've spent many, many a long afternoons in that area.
And that restaurant is all window, so
it's gorgeous.
It's a beautiful spot.
It's gorgeous. Well, listen, thank you so much. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
All right. it's alright. Pick up and say it's alright. And we talk all night.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Wisconsin cheese has proven time and time again to be a delicious expression of craft, hard work, and tradition. As a Cheeselandian, I am able to share a Gouda experience with fellow cheese and food lovers nationwide, as well as connect with cheese producers and cheesemongers, taking my love of cheese to another level. I invite you to join Cheeselandia because during these difficult times, it has been even more important to take it easy and get cheesy. The Cheeselandia community and events have been the glue helping to keep us together and connected, and I would love it if you would join me. And let's face it, if you hear the word cheese and get a little hungry, then you've found a place you can call home. To find out more about Cheeselandia, go to cheeselandia.com.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz, coming from the legendary Danger Bird Record Studio in Silver Lake. We are here with the Pantheons, Xavier, Sebastian, Omar, and Gary. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
What's up?
Hey, what's going on?
So most people know Compton as a place for hip-hop and that music scene from the 90s, but there's a whole new music scene coming out of it, which you guys are a part of. For those unfamiliar with that music scene, can you tell people about what's going on in the backyards of Compton these days?
Well, who wants to start off? Who wants to go?
I'll kick it off.
Well,
we started playing backyards like about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. We've all been playing the backyard scene for years since we were kids, because that's the cool thing about backyard shows and the punk scene in Compton and South Central, Downey, Long Beach, all those areas, is that, you know, all you need is like a couple buddies, you know, they don't even have to know how to play as long as they just show up, you know. And we've just been playing since we were like 12, 14, you know. So, like, the scene in Compton right now, like, everything's punk, ska, psychobilly, and metal. And what we're doing, it's something different, like, throwing in, like, elements of, like, goth and dark wave and stuff. So, that's what we're doing.
And it's a cohesive scene, right? It's not just, like, a band here, a band there. Like, there really is a good community vibe there.
Oh, definitely. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We got, yeah, like, a lot of up-and-coming bands, you know, that we play with, like, NNN. Freedom Curse, Diversity, Nocturnals, you know, like, we all play shows together, like, you know.
And how did you individually find yourselves?
And the Neurotics? No, sorry.
No, shout out. We're big shout on shout outs here. But how did you guys find your way into the scene? What drew you to it? Did you come in as fans first, or did you start a band and that's how you made your way
fans,
in?
Fans of music, really.
Definitely.
Yeah. Whatever was playing on the radio at the time.
Yeah. So, and is it fun to, like, come in as a fan, start your own band, and play with the guys that you were fans of?
Oh, hell yeah.
I think the best part is reading the music and, like, just because you guys hang out. Like, I think once you become a band, you become family. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of seeing each other
on the
daily.
Like a second marriage.
It is. Like, people don't realize stuff that's going on internal till you're inside the band.
Yeah.
And that's when you realize everything. But the good thing, you get to kind of, it's like a family member, you have to take everything, you know?
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a good place to have another place to go, right?
Yeah, like, it is. You need that breather. Like.
Yeah.
I mean, how has it all been important for you to have this community and this scene that's really your own And not having to, you know, come to downtown or come over to like Silver Lake. Yeah, like what's like to grow something out of your own home?
It's awesome. Well, we had a show yesterday, which is actually...
It was at your house, right?
Yeah, it was exactly right in my house. That's the first, you know, it's cool, you know? Because, you know, we don't have to rent out a venue. We don't have to, you know, worry about any of that stuff. It's just if someone has a backyard and they're like, hey, I want to do a show here. Boom, we set up a date and that's it. If it gets rated, it gets rated. But, like, we don't, you know, we're, like, super DIY. Like, we're, like if we want to do something, we do it then and there. We don't rent out clubs or any of that
I mean, we don't
stuff.
Mind playing clubs either.
Yeah, we don't mind them.
Hey, just for the record, we're available for booking. We're available for a green room. So for those who are unfamiliar with the Pantheons, how did you guys get started? Tell us a little bit about the band.
Well, Paul started the band.
When did the band start, Paul?
Well, we started officially as a band, because, you know, like, you know, at first you come up with like a thing, and you're just like dudes jamming out. You don't
like,
even have your
real?
Own sound.
It's not real. Like, this is a thing.
Mad members coming in and out. But officially, I would say January 2017, where I toured with these two guys. We went to this random tour in San Francisco. Like, January 2017, that's when we came out with our first EP as well, last year. And, that's when we officially began. I just wanted to do something different, you know, because we've been part of the scene since forever, and, you know.
Right, because the scene is, like, you know, is mostly punk, and what you were saying before, but you guys do have this goth element to it, which is a little bit, which is funny, because that's sort of how the history of punk was. Like, punk was, like, one thing, and then as it went on, it started to bring in these different elements and evolve.
And it turns into goth.
It turns into goth.
And we're trying to bring that back, you know, because people forget that, you know, goth, you know, squirrels and chipmunks are goth to punk, you know. Goth is punk. That's where it came from.
Yeah. How do people react to that? I mean, it is a unified scene, but when you start to do something different, sometimes people get a little eyebrows
raised.
You're
gonna have those people that are gonna end up jumping off your chip and stuff, and then joining something else, or not cool with it. But
we were doing the gigs, remember, first, and then it was weird. Like, people didn't accept that, like, when we were first playing, and that's when I think we started like we should do our own gigs, because people weren't.
Yeah,
they weren't responding, right, Paul?
Yeah, like, they were responding. You know, like, because, you know, they didn't know whether to pit to it or skank to it or what to do to it.
They didn't know what to do with it. Yeah. Like, nah, I'd rather not.
Sometimes you got to show people what to do with their hands in a new situation. But then they figure it out that it's all come from the same place, right?
Yeah. But I think, like, because the new wave of punks now are, like, way more accepting of, like, what we're doing.
Yeah,
so, like, they
too,
dance, they do whatever the heck they want, and we condone it.
Awesome. Well, let's hear a song. Let's hear it. What are you going to play for us first?
All right. The next one is called Motel. It's a new one. We're going to play some new ones today.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, we got Motel by the Pantheons here on Snacky Tunes at Danger Bird on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Welcome back. That
hey,
ripped.
How's it going? Whew.
I do like the sound. I do like the vibe. You know, L.A. has a long tradition of punk. Yeah. Germs, XCC, X, things like that. And I know that, Gary, you're talking about Misfits, which is not exactly L.A.
No, but
you know, it's like the L.A. scene, like everything, everyone from New York, even Sex Pistols made it out here. So what from like the original punk scene, like what are you pulling from, if both musically and then aesthetically, like what's your approach to your music? What did you love from the past?
Well, punk stuff, like, we're definitely fans of early punk, you know, 77.
Yeah.
I mean, 82, UK 82.2. But definitely, we get a lot from 70s punk bands.
Yeah,
I think we all love Misfits, honestly. Yeah. Like, that was kind of a weird thing that we clicked off in the beginning. We're all
Sam Hain. They're LA based.
When he came here. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. But we get a lot from 70s punk. Because it's. When that wave of punk came out, or that, you know, the first wave of punk came out, like, everybody sounded different, you know. Blondie was punk, Ramones were punk, The Damned were punk, you know, all these first bands, like Talking Heads, you know, they were all the new wave of like music at the time, and like they all sounded different, you know. It wasn't until like later on that all those bands started, you know, getting pigeonholed into the spiky hair studs and stuff.
Right.
So we were really like that early stuff because their influences were like, you know, T-Rex and glam and all that stuff. So
yeah, it was you know, and reading Please Kill Me and like learning about like the punk scene back then.
Yeah.
It was just, it was about having a place in a community, which is so much of what you guys are having now. And it was less about being, you're more rhythm guitar than a fast guitar. It was like, oh, you got keyboards. It was just, we all hung out at the same place and played music.
Yeah, definitely.
Now you guys have your own monthly night too, right? Which I guess you were saying came out of finding that something to do that was your own. How'd you start your own night? Why'd you want to start your own night? What's it called?
It's called Goth Night.
Beautiful. Love it.
Yeah, you know, simplicity. But nothing too fancy. Well, yeah, we did that because, yeah, we were tired of, like, the ska scene. And, you know, we love the punk scene and the metal scene and all that. But, you know, we wanted to do something our own, you know, something no one was doing, you know.
And so what's a Goth Night like?
Oh, it's pretty awesome.
It's like the blackest you'll ever see.
And we got this.
It's just nothing but
like dress code. Like,
yeah,
you get a discount if you show up in all black.
Yeah.
And we haggle kids, like, if they have, like, you know, they come with like band shirts, like with the white print. We're like, nope.
Yeah, all black.
Just to fuck with them. Yeah, all black. No, but it's all fun.
Nah, we fuck with them. But it's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, we only get like two or three bands. Because most of it is, like, to throw in that 80s goth club vibe, you know?
Yeah.
But for, like, a lot of kids that can't go to clubs, you know, or all that stuff, like, we bring it to the backyard scene.
I mean, the fact that it's all ages is pretty important to give access to people who are younger. Why do you guys like doing all-ages show? What do you get of a different vibe at those types of events?
You know, there's more of a rush because, you know, kids don't care. They just, you know, they do whatever they want.
I would say, like, when I was younger, too, it was more taboo. And,
it was, I
and
remember.
Now it's like they kind of have that. I would have to say that the parents now are more lenient, so they're like, all right, it's nothing that bad.
Right.
80s bullshit. Like, a lot of them like that shit. So
right.
It's cool, you know? Like,
they're like, can I come?
Yeah.
Can I come hang out in the back?
Like,
yeah. They're like, oh, this is my music.
So, parents are the roadies, too.
Yeah.
It's
exactly.
So, like, just cool.
Yeah,
it's cool.
They're supportive. Surprisingly, there's some bands that have their parents as roadies. And
or managers.
Yeah.
They're looking out for them, making sure.
I feel like it's a good idea for kids who don't got that chance or can go. I mean, if you're gonna get fucked up responsibly, you know.
Well, didn't you say that? Because a lot of times punk is such a like a angry or like need a response to like a bad family life or like things are not good. But it seems like it's swung back where parents now can find a bond over the music that you guys are helping share with these kids.
Yeah, because a lot of the punks from, like, you know, the 80s or this, you know, the 90s or whatever, yeah, their parents were, like, what, baby boomers or something, you know, they came, you know. But now the kids from, you know, this generation, their parents were the punks or, you know, the rockers and stuff, so they're more accepting.
Yeah, they can relate.
They can relate because they went to shows of their own and things like that.
They know there's bad elements. Not if you, you know, embrace those elements, then you should be good.
Hmm. Awesome. Well, let's hear another song.
All right.
What are you guys going to play for us?
This next one is called it's called Belasco Tendency. It's a new one.
Awesome. Well, another new jam from the Pantheons at Dangerbird Record Studios.
Let's do it, guys.
Here on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, yeah.
Let's do this.
Rip that shit up.
Up to nine.
Another heater. A real ripper.
Yeah,
it's
man.
It's a banger, man. Nothing but ragers.
Funnest one to play.
Now, you guys have been playing out for a while. When did you decide that you wanted to start recording? How did that work? At what point do you start saying, we got enough songs that we want to, you know?
I think that's when, well, you put it right now. Like, when people started noticing and started being like, hey, you guys are good. It's like, fuck, now we got to come out with a demo or something. Like, music to
yeah. play here. Well, because, I mean, how much of it, of this scene is live shows versus recording, or is it a mix? You know, it's like, you know, you're putting out a lot of songs on Bandcamp or, you know, digital platforms or 7 inches mm-hmm. versus playing as many shows as possible.
Well, I think playing shows comes first. Yeah, because we haven't recorded in about a year. We're going to head back to the studio and do a new album. That should be due, I want to say late January, early February, but mostly live shows. You know, that's the main thing. We play almost every weekend.
Yeah,
you know, because mm-hmm. we love it. You know,
let's talk about that first EP, Ballet of Gunfire. Mm-hmm. How did it come about? What was the process?
Oh man, well, Paul, like, he shot me a bunch of ideas for song names, and that one was cool. I thought it was like, what should be slapping on the EP, you know? Yeah. It's a good name. Like,
no, it was good. Cool. They were, at that time, they were working at it together. I think it was just them two, because they were kind of having trouble with members. But, like, when I first heard the bass lines, he shot them to me, and I was like, wow, like, I love it. Like,
so yeah.
We started playing it, but they were coming up with a lot of stuff.
So, right now, we're not, well, yeah, like Paul said, we're going to go back and record it. But, yeah, those little things, I don't know if we'll come up with, like, EPs or little singles here and there throughout the time. Really. We might, you know, we've done it before, but right now I think we're just focused on trying to record the album.
Awesome. Now,
and shows.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know merch was such a big part of the punk scene. Is that big for you guys, like, doing the DIY shirts and everything like that, or is it...
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because
I feel like now it's, like, that weird crossover with, like, Supreme and Limited Drops, and bands now are doing, like, we're going to make 20 of these shirts, and you get them at the shows, and we'll make 20 different shirts.
Yeah. It's like they ride, you know, the waves of, like, certain aesthetics, and, you know, they go with it. Especially, like, yeah, with Supreme and all that stuff, and SoundCloud rappers, like, they have, like, a specific look, and they cash in on it.
Yeah.
And everybody cashes in on it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, for us, aesthetics is, like, super important. Well, for me, personally, when I make, like, the visuals, because... You know, I'm an art major, so, like, all the, you know, visuals just, I love them, you know. You know, color coordination or, you know, art pieces that just look neat. I just look at album covers and, you know, just get ideas, just different stuff, you know.
I mean, I've always loved that about sort of the punk underground scene is that it's all sort of one art voice, and there's just different ways to represent it, whether it's the music or the pins that mm-hmm. you guys make or the shirts that you make. How do you find the best way, like, what's the best ideal of representing your whole vibe?
Okay, I guess pins right now. Don't we get shirts?
We have some pins in the
shirt. No, don't forget, guys, remember when we went to San Fran, we took stickers and shirts.
Oh, yeah.
And we had our first gig. We were kind of nervous. We went on the road, and this guy told me, I literally joined the band, like, a month in, I think.
A month prior,
and he told me, you want to go? And I wasn't, with my band, we were kind of delaying, and we went over there, and they embraced us when we played in, what city was it?
Ventura.
We played there, and it was embracing, like, this is literally, like, we were in the room, we were playing, we played the first song, and I look up, and I see these guys all into it, and the room was packed, dude. Like, it was, like, everybody was dancing.
I mean, that was like a year ago.
It was
in comparison to, you know, 1 year ago, the scene is different than now.
Yeah.
But 1 year ago, like...
That was out of Compton, though.
Yeah, Compton was, like, you know, they didn't really care for our stuff.
We had to play out of the city.
Yeah.
We had to play out of the city because people didn't understand the music that we were trying to do.
And now, definitely.
Oh,
people have embraced you. What was the change? Like, when did you realize that the people, when they finally get it together embrace you and understand what you were doing?
Well, actually, I like to think that because there's, like, this new wave of punk. And before, like, a year, two, 5 years ago, it was, like, the punk scene was, like, mostly dominant in, like, South Central and, like, downtown L.A. and stuff like that. But, like, now it's more leaning towards, like, North Long Beach. And, like it's, like, a new wave of punks that kind of came on and... They dug it more than the old ones, but then the older heads, like, they're like, oh, well, okay, you know.
Well, the young kids like it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, how fast, like, let's say I were to dip out of the scene for 3 or 4 months and then come back in. How different would it be? How fast is it changing? What's influencing that that rapid change?
It changes, you know, very...
I think that...
It's just, very volatile.
I think people got tired of it. Like, because it was... I think ska and punk has been so dominant in an area that people were just fed up with it. Because you go to shows and it's like sometimes it would just be our punker friends there and they're watching them. Like when I used to go to shows, I'm talking about a while ago, but we would just be watching it. And like, hey, what's happening this week? Oh, it's a ska show. We're like, oh, we'll just stay home.
Yeah.
Like, it was the same old...
So you're like, oh, like you're just a ska band doing the ska sound that you saw the show.
No, don't get me wrong. We have friends that play in ska bands and we appreciate it. But it was just so dominant that it's kind of like, okay.
I think that if you leave for 3 months and come back, you probably wouldn't find anything right away. Mm-hmm. But there's always something going on.
Yeah. Dude, that's crazy. Yeah. So you got the new album coming out. Show every week. What do you guys see for the future of the band? What do you guys want to be doing?
Well, we don't see it. We always think everything like short term, you know. Like we don't think about that far ahead. We just, you know, what we do in today, we do. We live in the now. Yeah, basically, you know, like make the best out of every day. So.
Like this is fucking awesome. I never done this before. Yeah. I would like
thanks
to do
for
this
coming.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
We appreciate it. We appreciate it a lot.
More too.
But like, yeah, we always think short term, you know, because like we don't like.
Like after this, you're gonna be like, what's next?
Yeah. We don't like that mentality. It's just like, oh, tomorrow, you know, so-and-so has a pin machine. Let's go make pins. All right. You know, just, you know, make a goal for, like, every week. Mm-hmm. We don't see everything, like, in a monthly or, like, yearly, you know, plan
you
that we
task
do.
Yourself, and then you get all crazy.
Exactly. Because then, you know, and the anticipation for it is, you know, leaves a lot of room for procrastination.
Yeah. I hear that.
And, yeah.
Are there any other comparable scenes? I know you said San Francisco, but are there other scenes that you're across America that have the same sort of vibe that's going on in Compton, or is it just completely unique to what's
happening?
I
think
happening?
There is. I think there is.
I think it's always there somewhere.
Yeah.
I would say.
Everywhere else,
I
mean, their own little scene, their own little backyard scene.
Yeah, I know I saw a documentary in Mexico City, like, I think less than 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah?
And there's a big goth scene happening right now, too. Like, it's not big, but it's kind of, it's still there, you know
there's
what I mean?
There's a punk scene in Pakistan.
Yeah, like you know, I think everything is always around the world. It's just that it's not seen in the light. You know what I mean?
Yeah, LA will always get the you know the spotlight because you know that has a history with punk.
Yeah.
You know, like places like I don't know, like
the Whiskey, Roxy. What?
Yeah,
yeah.
But like other states, like I don't know, whatever other state,
Oak
you know.
Dogs.
Florida, whatever, like, you know, they don't get, you know, because who do they have?
They had Less Than Jake, punk ska, yeah. Oh, yeah,
exactly.
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Shout out to Kong, because Conger, the other guy on Snacky Tunes, he's an old Florida punk guy.
There he is.
I saw him coming.
He's all coming in.
Tell him about Florida. He's cracked up right now.
Scratch that.
He's
Florida
got
has Kong.
Florida's got Kong. They got some stories. Oh, yeah. He's got some stories about going to see NOFX and pickup trucks. And now with the internet, because like back in the day, like it was like writing letters, making phone calls, things like that. But with Instagram, things like that, it's got to be easier to like book shows, build a community,
it's super
right?
Fast-paced.
Yeah,
it's like so fast paced. You can get like, especially if you have a good reputation. I think
you gotta be a nice guy, right?
Yeah, I think so. Like the best way because
you do good
can
and good things will happen to you.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Awesome. And before we run out, because I want to make sure we have one more song, Omar, I know you own a restaurant.
Yeah.
Out in Compton, Alexander's World Famous Tortas.
Yep.
For those who've never been, what's the deal? What's the vibe? Because it got music. There's music there too, right?
Yeah, like all the guys eat there. Like,
it's a rock and roll restaurant.
Everybody supports there. Yeah. I think the rock scene. The reason we did it too, because like you said, hip hop is so dominant in Compton.
Yeah.
So when we started doing that, everybody's like, "What the heck?" Like they would walk in, and you know the food's good. We tend to our customers. Our main thing is customer service.
Beautiful.
Besides the food being, you know,
food number one.
Yeah.
Equal customer service.
Exactly.
And good music.
And good music. We're always bumping. We even bump. We bump locals. We bump everything that's happening too. So we switch it out, and we're tending to the neighborhood. I would say.
It's cool to have a clubhouse with good food.
Yeah, heck yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty awesome.
Much, yeah.
You need vegan options.
Vegan options.
Yeah.
You can fry up some, what is it, jackfruit? I don't know. Right?
Yeah. That's what I was telling you.
And then Tuesdays.
I would know nothing about that. I mean.
Tuesdays we have music open. So sometimes
live music.
Live music. Every other Tuesday some bands will come. Like, but some of the guys work, but there's a lot of good bands that come out.
Yeah. Like after, you know, we punch out of work, like some guys just go and chill out at the restaurant and
play
jam out.
Songs. Yeah. We give them some food and everybody's happy, and you know.
Dude, that's awesome. I love it. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming by. where can people find your music? Where can people find out about your shows?
You can find our stuff on Spotify, iTunes, every musical platform, YouTube, if you don't want to pay for that stuff. And you could check us out on Pantheon's Official on Instagram. And you could email us through there, too.
Awesome.
ThePantheonsMusic@gmail.com.
And what's the last song we're going to hear?
This last song is a more punkier one. It's called Benson and Hedges.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, guys. Thank you to Dangerbird. Thank you to everyone. One last song from Pantheons. Then we'll see you next week on Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Yeah! talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for...
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
Listening.